Please pray with me, O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Dearest Mother.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Peace.
Peace.
Bliss.
Bliss.
Amen. Gives me such joy to be with all of you this morning and to have this time when we focus our attention upon God. I want to read you an announcement for the ordination of Jill Huff. For some time now, I have deeply felt that there was a time coming when a new generation of teachers and ministers were forming. Depending upon the soul, it takes time to come to the point where one may perform rituals such as marriage, baptisms, and funerals, to teach, and even give initiation, or diksha. Mother started me on this journey when she was inwardly directed to ordain me a minister. I contemplated the term minister, and I peeled back the layers of time to the original Latin, minister meaning servant, or to serve. I thought to serve, what in India is called seva, is something I can strive to do. It is a noble task, my dharma. Mother Hamilton described how she felt when Paramahansa Yogananda ordained her a minister. She felt unworthy of the honor. However, as time went on, she saw that being a minister for Master and for God helped to perfect her. I too, through the succeeding nearly 30 years of being a minister, can say that being a minister has also greatly helped me in ascending nearer to my infinite beloved. One who comes to this path is automatically committed to the universal love and service. However, when one has karmic connections with others, and as a result it is his dharma to help them through the role of being a minister, then he or she must take the task on humbly, cheerfully, and with clear intention of selfless service. Through fulfilling his duty as a minister, he may help others to their realization of God, and thereby help to free himself as well. And now it has been ordained by the Infinite that Jill Huff should enter into the life of being a minister. She will take the vows that will ensure that she will carry on the traditions as set by my Guru Dev, to serve simply, without fanfare, and to do so freely, without the constraints of organization or doing other than to please God and gurus. Jill will be a bearer of light and love. Through this service, she will further her journey to the infinite. Please add your blessings and support to her in her desire to perfect herself and serve all as embodiments of the divine, ever in the eternal light of the masters, David. Ordination will take place in Mount Vernon, Sunday, August 25th. I have here, correct, 25th. Of this month, and it'll be part of our service. They'll be held in Mount Vernon, and then with the ordination and also a potluck that will follow afterwards. So I hope that you all can make it. You know, each one of us has our own story of coming to the Guru and discovering, and Jill's is perhaps different from some, in the sense that we originally worked together at a mental health center as counselors for chronically mentally ill. And she was a somewhat under me in terms of roles and positions at a certain place where we worked. And within a short time, she recognized something different within this soul, within this person. And she thought, whatever it is that he has, I want. And that it was some years in developing both as a professional relationship and then in terms of a spiritual relationship. And she has always sought to serve in whatever way possible. One time, somebody who had been with Mother and been with the work for many years and saw the different things that Jill was doing, and she said, well, how did you get into such a position? And she said, well, I just looked around and saw in whatever way that I could help, I just started doing it. And so this devotee said, oh, and walked away, I think unimpressed with that. It reminded me of Bhattaji when she first came out to see Papa, and Papa had a very small ashram and just one other person out there with him, and some people would come out and sit and be with him. But when she discovered him, she recognized the greatness of God within him. So many others did not at the time. And so she just looked around when she had gotten kind of the feeling and chanting of Ram Nam and just what to do. And she picked up a broom and just started sweeping and started doing things around the ashram there. And then Papa wanted to help universalize her life. And so he instructed her to go out and just started going to people's houses and offering to help, offering to sweep, to wash clothes, to do whatever was needed. And so she would do. So she had two children of her own, but she had some time, and so she would go out and do that. And she was instructed to see God in each person that she would enter their house. Can you imagine? Just going to your neighbors, knocking on their door, is there anything that I can do to help? And just getting to work and doing it. But in this way, Papa didn't want her overly focused just on his form, although that's necessary, particularly in the beginning, before our vision is universalized, that we have that love and devotion for God in the Guru. And Mataji certainly had that with Papa, and it was a lifelong affair for her. But he wanted her also to not isolate her vision strictly to Papa, but that she wanted her to see God in everyone and in everything, and to serve God in everyone and everywhere. When Swamiji first came to the ashram and started living there, and he would serve different ones, and he saw God so greatly in both Papa and Mataji. But so many people came to the ashram, and he didn't have the purified vision where he could see them all as God, and he felt himself getting caught up in judgment and thinking of one thing about this person and something else about another. And he felt that he couldn't serve properly without having that universal vision. So it was his idea that he should go up unto the Ganges and in isolation and chant God's name until he had that universal vision. Then he can come back and serve. And so Mataji and Papa both had a discussion about that. And Papa was in favor of the idea, thought, yes, that's a good thing for him to do. But Mataji said, no, let him serve here. And through his service, his vision will be purified. Well, in that moment, at least, Swamiji's and Papa's wills reign supreme. And he went up to the Ganges, and he's up there for some months in a little hut near the Ganges there in Haridwar, in that area. Rishikesh, Haridwar, I think he was up in Rishikesh. And he was chanting Ram Nam and just feeling greatly benefited by having that opportunity to step outside of life's procession for a little while. Then he got a letter from Papa and saying they were going to go on tour around India, and would he come and serve as secretary while they were on this tour. So he did so, since Papa was asking him to. And that he did so dutifully with all the intention of going back into isolation again. And so it came about that he was training somebody else to take over his position when he left. And just as the transition time, Swamiji had all of his bags packed, ready to go back up into isolation. I don't imagine it was too many bags, probably a bag with a extra cloth, something like that, traveling very light. He had his bags packed and ready to go. And the man got word that he had been training, that his father had passed away, and he must come back home and see to the affairs. And so he sought permission to do so. And with that, Swamiji and Papa and Mataji all took it that this was God's will for Swamiji to stay on. He unpacked his bags and he never packed them again. He stayed there at the ashram only. And there have been, were times when he would go into isolation for some periods of time to chant, sometimes, many times, just right on the ashram grounds. He'd just go into his room, his simple meals, as they were brought to him, and he would stay chanting 20, 22 hours out of the day, seeking to perfect himself, but also through his service, he was able to perfect himself. And through that perfection, more and more, he was able to see all beings as manifestations of God. This is no small thing that we have endeavored to go to, this universal vision, the seeing God in everyone and everything. And it takes a dedication, a complete dedication of mind, of heart, of intent and purpose. And yet we are also householder yogis. We live in this world. And so it is through serving others, it is by being in this world that we are actually helped to perfect our lives, whether we are serving as a minister in a formal sense or as a devotee and a sadhaka, because we are all called to universal love and service. And when you accept it, that whatever placement God has put you into, that it is perfect for you, the people that you are surrounded with, it's no accident. Those that you are given to love and to serve are perfect for you and will help to perfect you. When you accept that completely and get rid of resentment. Resentment is one of the biggest barriers. I just think my life should be easier. Things should go better and easier. I shouldn't have to struggle with these things. That itself keeps you attached to those things. And so to accept your lot cheerfully, humbly, with a pure intent to find God through the very experiences you are given. And when you let go of resentment and a feeling that something should in your outer circumstances change and be like Sister Gyanamata, whose God gave her the prayer, Lord, don't change my circumstances, change me. And how many of us pray to change our circumstances? But see how powerful that prayer is. Don't change my circumstances, change me. And even as you think about praying that prayer, you just may find yourself resistant to it. No, I want my circumstances changed. Are you kidding me? Because it is the belief that if our circumstances are changed, then we will be changed. And this gives all the power to the world and not to the inner hidden resources of God within. I would like to read to you from Swami Ramdas, the book Swami Ramdas on Himself. And these are various remarks that he made about his sadhana years. And he says, God was busy with his own handiwork, changing everything about Ramdas. Ramdas knew after a few years that he was reborn. Some years after this transformation, an old friend of Ramdas, whom he was working with in the pre-sannyas days, wanted to talk to him over the telephone. That friend asked, may I speak to Vittal Roy? That was Ramdas's name as a householder. Ramdas replied, Vittal Roy is dead and gone. This is Ramdas speaking here. The friend was shocked to hear this and said, if Vittal Roy is dead and gone, I have nothing to do with Ramdas. He replaced the receiver and left. So the old man is dead and a new one is born. To tell you the truth, when God wanted Ramdas to leave his family, his old family you may call it, and go on a wandering life, he did not know why he was going. He went because God led him away from that place. He had no idea what was in store for him. It was for sadhana. Why should he go anywhere? If it was for sadhana, why should he go anywhere else? He could have practiced sitting at home. Still, God wanted him to go. Ramdas did not ask him why he was being taken away, but he himself whispered in Ramdas' ear, "Ramdas, I am taking you from place to place, not because you have to renounce everything, but because you have to see that everything is my form. You have to go to householders and tell them that they need not renounce worldly life in order to realize me." It was with this object that he made him give up his old life. I think for many, there is the thought, and for some, even the prejudice, that you're something lesser of a devotee, of an aspirant for God, if you don't wear the orange cloth, or if you don't renounce everything completely. And this is a fallacy. Some of the greatest masters, some of the greatest saints, Kabir and so many others, were householders. Of course, our own beloved guru, Mother Hamilton, was a householder. And Sri Yukteswar was for many years. And so many others, through their life of sadhana, through their life within the home, within serving their own family, serving the world through a particular profession, that their minds, their hearts, their souls were perfected in God. I thought you would like to hear, I just picked up some diary notes from that I made when I was in Anandashram, thinking about going back to Anandashram. And this is from 1998, December 6th. And I write, "The Mandir comes to life at 5:30 a.m. as the silent processioners circumambulate the ashes of Mataji. Mataji has taken on a deep personal and impersonal meaning for me. On a couple of occasions here at the ashram, desire nature has raised its seductive head. You see, when the soul comes into incarnation, it comes from wholeness or completeness of infinite divine consciousness. The particle of frozen sky, like a hologram, reflects the macrocosm of the whole sky. In order to assume an ego, an individual identity must separate itself from its own wholeness. It creates a veil of separation around its consciousness, aware by the power of Maya and darkness. Thus, it leaves behind, outside conscious awareness, its entirety, its wholeness. Like an actor who becomes absorbed in his role for conscious awareness, like an actor who becomes absorbed in his role for a time, leaves behind his identity as an actor. Such a distinct separation is temporary and has no true substance or reality. But for the pleasure of playing the role, this is what is done. Proceeding through successive planes of consciousness, evolution of the soul is awakened to its complete sense of itself, what it has never really ceased to be. A sheath or a veil of delusion drops and the soul moves from the awareness of the mineral kingdom to the vegetable. Another veil drops, and now it assumes an animal role, then human. Evolution is not the formation of something new, although that is how it appears to the perception from that point of view of one involved in the magic play. Rather, it is the reclaiming in consciousness what the soul has always been. The duality resolves itself, reclaims a part of itself consciously on one level, then moves to the next. Desire nature of the soul is the source of power and keeps the veil active. What requires effort, personal will, is not the dropping of the veil, but the sustaining of it. The actor, once he has deluded himself in his role, is seduced by that role. As an unconscious act of will, he continues the role, whether a comedy, tragedy, playing the role of a hero or a villain, being born or dying. The seductiveness of living that life sweeps one away by its power, mystery, and ultimate fun. How many actors love playing a tragic role? How we love our veils, one of the most fundamental parts of our wholeness that drops into the subconscious mind is that of the sexual opposite. For males, it is the female, females, the male. In this way, we search out our opposite in the form of a partner to make ourselves complete. This keeps the play going on a physical and on a conscious level. In order to complete ourselves, drop all the veils. We have to cure ourselves of our desire for the seductive illusion that a partner will be our completion. This is so basic and fundamental to our nature, physically, emotionally, and mentally, it can seem well impossible for the aspirant. The cure is in experiencing our wholeness spiritually. Then the veil of illusion is broken because the desire to prop it up is no longer there. For the aspirant, the defining moment comes in the realization in their completeness from within, not without. This is done by purifying body, emotions, and mind of all binding desires. This is not done in a day, only hit and miss, having some experience of internal wholeness, then returning to the veil. The sadhaka gradually realizes the superior soul joy to the veil of pleasures promised by physical love. Since physical love is in duality, there is pain for every pleasure. Therefore, the promise of absolute union can never be fulfilled in that way. As Jesus said, from the beginning, the delusive force is a liar. It promises everything, but like a dishonest salesman, it cannot deliver. So when these desires grab for my attention, I have fought the battle from Mataji's fortress. In her mandir, I have gone to pray, O Divine Mother, your spirit is universal. The colossal universe has sprung from your being. You are creator, sustainer, and destroyer of all that is. Absorb me in your being. Make me complete in thee. O Divine Mother, I have sought you without, but it has ultimately brought only tears and pain. Make me seek you within, that I may find the everlasting glory of your presence, residing within my whole being. O Divine Mother, you are my completeness. You alone can make me whole. Absorb this little me into the infinite you. In this way I prayed. Grace came to me, veils dropped one by one, desire nature transmuted from human to divine. I bow in reverence and gratitude. O Divine Mother, I pray. O Divine Mother, keep me in your being now and always. Om, peace, bliss, amen. Today, while walking in Mataji's mandir, I felt the fullness in my heart, again like the belly of a pregnant woman filled with hundreds, perhaps thousands of children. As I walked, the floor of the mandir subtly changed and became consciousness itself. Through some divine alchemy, it was as moving water, much as experienced at Satya Sai Baba's, and yet I walked upon it. Could this be the inner meaning to Jesus walking on water? All materiality comes alive in this liquid-like motion as divine consciousness. Truly, it was holy ground. And then continued a little later, why do you go to a teacher to listen to his words? What can he say that has not already been said? You go as the child goes to the mother. The child who is left in the daycare cries for its mother alone. The paid professionals try all the tricks in the book. Nothing satisfies the child. They consult their theoretical books, think back on their education. All their knowledge does not stop the cries and lamentation of the little tyke. Now they call the mother where she is busy elsewhere Come, get your child who's being naughty, and we cannot keep a bad child. The mother drops what she is doing and rushes to her beloved. When she arrives, the child hears its mother's voice and runs to her lap. It is only there the child calms itself and feeds on the mother's presence. She tells it stories which the child likes, but more than the words which go unheard, it is the sweet vibration of the mother's voice. How much the true devotee is like that child when they meet their beloved, their Satguru. They hear in their voice the sound of their divine mother. They may not recognize it right away due to confusions of so many voices they have heard. But soon they hear it, the tones of their beloved. Then they calm and feel the bliss of their coming home. Mother alone knows the way home and operates through a realized guru. Paid child care providers are the ministers, priests, and rabbis without realization. They cannot know the way or soothe the seeker. All glory to the true guru, Jai Guru. And then continued a bit later. Swamiji was asked about surrender and discipline at the ashram. Does one who is doing their own sadhana and does not come to programs, is that all right? Swamiji, one who is engaged in sadhana must stay in their own rooms. It is when they are not doing intense enough sadhana that the problems come. It shows up as problems with insufficient sadhana. I thought of this remark, and it is another way of saying the tree is known by its fruits. I thought of Kriyananda as an example of insufficient sadhana. I thought of the times in my own life when problems came about due to my not being engaged heavily enough in sadhana. Other examples come to mind, yet this principle is quite true. Its simplicity is profound. Trouble always erupts due to insufficient sadhana, a truth to keep in uppermost in mind. Jai Ram, Jai Guru, Jai Swamiji. And then continued again. This afternoon at Darshan, I felt my waiting soul being filled with the fountain of divine power and love coming through the great spirit of Swamiji. After he left on his walk, I felt directed to Mataji's mandir, where the men were singing God's sweet name. The vibration of the name being sung is felt in the body and being of the devotee and produces a positive feeling of bliss. I went with the idea of complete freedom from all outward desires. But as I slipped my sandals off, the thought came, why ask for an intermediate goal, i.e. freedom from desires? Ask, rather, for the ultimate goal. So I arranged my prayer. O Lord, Infinite Divine Mother, raise me to your ultimate realization of universal vision. Make me one with thee. Entering in as I swept up in a divine mood, rather a deepening divine mood, I again walked on the waves of consciousness. The thought continued to center on myself as if all were focused on me. Indeed, I could feel a wonderful Swami behind me who was aware of my divine mood and followed close on my heels. Again I prayed, O Mother, cure me of this egocentric idea. Collapse this ego. Make me thy child as I truly am. Suddenly the idea came that all the grace and the change, all the capacity in me to feel and know God was due to those who had gone before me, all those great saints who themselves had trod the path and hallowed the ground with their devotional vibration. All I experience in God is due to them leading the way with their support behind me, lifting me beyond my previous self. I felt them supporting me from behind, leading ahead. I was the product of their sweet grace and love. Their protection kept me from harm and wandering too far off. I sang and walked in gratitude and ecstatic joy at this realization. After the men had finished at the bottom of the hour, I walked outside flush with the light of humble awe. The Swami, who I knew was behind me the whole time, but I never saw, came toward me with eyes that gleamed of God, pronam before me. I put my hands over his and touched my forehead to his radiant form. He in turn touched his forehead to my hands. Oh, what joyous pronouns! to meet in body the representative of all who have gone before me and stand behind me as a solid support for my realization. Om Shanti, Om Guru. Who comes to me in so many forms? Can this form of yours contain all the blessings of your sweet grace? Om Guru, Om Mother, Om my beloved, now and forevermore. So I thought you might enjoy hearing some of my experiences of being in the ashram from 1998. What blessed grace it is that has put us on this path to realization. It is the ultimate adventure. It is the greatest thing that any human being can embark upon. There are so many who walk this earth who have no idea of anything that resides within them that could be called God or realization of God. It is a shame in a sense, but it is all God's play. Those who keep up the veil must actively do so. We realize that when we let down some aspect of the veil, or some aspect of the veil is suddenly let down around us, and we feel such a relief. We feel how much life energy of ours it has taken in order to erect the veil. Oftentimes we think about how much energy it takes for us to do our sadhana, to think of God, to chant God's name. And true, it must be an act of will until that grace comes in and begins to activate it through us. But whatever amount of willpower it takes for us to think on God, there is so much more that is required to keep the veil up, to keep ourselves in role. We oftentimes see ourselves as God realization is something that we have to create, something that we have to make happen. But this is a fallacy. God realization already exists within you. It's a matter of allowing the veils to drop. There are so many whom I work with who have the knowledge, they have the prescription, and yet they find it difficult because there is fear that is behind. Jerry Jamplowski once wrote a wonderful little book that called Love is Letting Go of Fear. And I think he's absolutely right. All lack of love, all lack of God is really based on fear. And with that fear, we don't enter in to that wonderful stream of grace that is constantly flowing to us. Many times we think that God has to open up the doors of grace in order for us to get that realization. But the truth is we have to open the doors. We are keeping them closed. We are actively keeping them closed. And it requires life. It requires energy. It requires at least an unconscious intention to keep those doors closed. How wonderful it is to think that you are already a perfectly realized being. If you would only allow yourselves to receive this, to accept it. That God is already in you so tremendously. This experience that I talked about, that the floor of the mandir as we walked and chanted on would become as liquid-like. And it had a flowing motion. That's what it's like in consciousness. You can have that experience where this entire world becomes a motion of life energy, of prana, with a capital P. It is God itself. And everything is scintillating and vibrating with that. That you live in a sea of bliss. It is true. The air that you breathe is bliss itself. The walls of this room, the ceiling, the floor, everything is bliss. Everything is in motion. Everything is of consciousness. And as you rise up, you realize this. You move from the energetic where you can feel that everything is made up of life energy and scintillating with it. And then you can go into that more subtle realm of the causal. I've described to you before one of my first experiences in that wonderful causal realm as I walked down a forested path. And the trees and the path and everything suddenly took on a brand new experience. It was as if a veil had dropped. And I no longer saw it as physical. I no longer saw it as life energy even. I saw it as an idea projected out from God. And the path that I was walking on, my body, the trees, everything was an idea. Now, that can't really convey the subtlety, the joy, the bliss that experience contained. It becomes very, very subtle. But if you can imagine it, and then just feeling that this is all a projection of God's thought, and how close you are to God in being that projection of thought, and then that all circumference, all limitation suddenly dissolves like a bubble around you dissolving, and you merge into the great and infinite sea of spirit. And now there is no circumference. There is no limitation. Everything is part of that one consciousness. Oftentimes we can think that going to God, we leave behind everything and everyone else. And there is that sense of it in our upward journey that we have to let go of our attachment to everything. But really, as you enter into that universal consciousness, it's not that everything is left behind. You are now a part of everything. Everything that you have held dear, everything that you have loved. But now there is no threat of it being taken away, because that which you once have, you will always have in God. The fullness, the completeness, the love, the joy, the ecstasy, everything is yours. What is left behind is all limiting idea that has caused you pain and sorrow. The Buddha, with his absolute crystal clarity of mind, diagnosed the problem as our attachments are what keep us from knowing this divine consciousness completely and fully. And that if in letting go of those attachments, we let go of any sense of limitation, any sense that you are an individual only. I was thinking this morning of young teenagers and how difficult it is at their time. Because I think in particular there comes a sense of I-ness that's new as you enter into puberty. And in a sense, it creates even more of a sense of distance, more of a sense of separation. And so many people at that stage, they think, well, other people don't have this sense of isolation, but the truth is everyone does. And so you live in that sense of isolation, and it's kind of a desperate isolation. And you try to make up for it by getting a handle on this earth. Okay, I want to meet somebody who's special. And I want perhaps to have a profession that will be fulfilling. And we look to fill in the gaps of that emptiness with all these things of the world. And one day perhaps I will have children, and you fill in with that whole life. And so your life continues, and you continue to try to fill in that gap, try to fill in that hole, that need that's deep within you. But the truth is that it cannot be filled in with the things of this world, never completely, never fully, never satisfactorily. There's always something that is left. There's something that's not fulfilled in that. And even if you get moments of complete fulfillment, it's what people look for in sexual union, is they look for that complete collapse of the ego and that mergence into, and you can achieve that on a temporary basis, but it can't stay with you. And so then the field of separation begins to form around you again. And so you go from one thing to another, from one partner to another, one thing to another, on and on and on you go. Through lifetimes you go. Until finally the idea comes to you, it seems as if there's nothing in this world that can satisfy me. There was the comedian who one time said, he says, you know, I've always heard that money can't buy you happiness. He says, I just wish I had enough to really prove it. Because we think so, don't we? Or we think that if we have just the right person in our life, and just the list goes on, of what that idyllic life would be that would fulfill you, that would complete you, that would give you that total happiness. But we're so designed in such a way that there's nothing that can give us that complete and lasting happiness in this world. Only God can do that. And gradually, through these earth experiences, we come to that recognition and realization. There are some people who think, well, when I die, then I'll get all the answers, and then I'll be complete, and then I'll be one with God. And yet, where is that so? What we realize, what we find, is that we are very much ourselves, a better version of ourselves, perhaps, but very much ourselves. And we still have the desire nature that keeps us separate. And we must return if we have unfulfilled earth desires in order to fulfill our desires here, because God doesn't want us incomplete in any ways whatsoever. And this belief that we suffer under, that it is the outer world that brings us completeness, you see, this makes us attached. When you realize that God within you is all that you really need, it doesn't mean that you don't need to eat. It doesn't mean that you can't have a spouse, if that's what it's destined for you, or children, or a home. All of these things are wonderful, and they're good things when they are in their proper position in life. As long as we don't attach ourselves to them as the be-all, end-all. But when we begin to see God in them, we begin to see God in our spouse, we begin to see God in our home, we begin to see God in our children, and so on. Then you begin to universalize your vision. And then it's not just your children, but it's everyone's children. And you feel that same kindred spirit. You feel that same love. You see, it's attachment that says only this and none other. And that keeps us from the universal vision. So to expand your circle of love, to expand your circle of light, to expand your vision so that it incorporates more and more of this world and all the beings in it. And now there are no strangers. Everywhere you go, you are meeting yourself. You are meeting God. Everything that you do is a manifestation of God's Spirit within you. You feel God prompting you. Now, this is not just simply imagination, and you can't make it up. We can be deceived along the way, but when we get it, when we know that this is God's prompting, it comes from a source that is different than our own conscious mind. And we feel it. We know it. And as I say, we can be fooled. There are times when we are fooled, and we are seduced back into this world of duality. And through that seduction, we go through many painful experiences, and perhaps we cause pain for others as well. And we think, well, that didn't work out very well. Back to the drawing board. I thought that was God's prompting, or perhaps I didn't even think it was God's prompting. You know, it's an interesting thing to do when you're faced with a decision. Put all the masters around you. Just see them all around you. Present the idea. How well does it match with them? What do they have to say about it? Do they smile in light? Or is there something that you know is not right about what you're doing? And you want to do it in darkness, that's a very good clue. This is not God's prompting. This is something to stay away from. And yet, at times, we can get seduced into it. And we think that it's all right on some level. We work to convince ourselves that it's all right. But it's not all right. And eventually the bill comes due. It's like having a credit card that you can go out and charge things on. And it's fun while you can do it. But then the bill comes due. And you don't even have the product any longer. It's just the bill. You have to pay the price. And then you think, my Lord, when will I ever learn? When will I ever learn that by following these outward desire natures, it does not bring me real happiness, lasting happiness? And it will never, it can never. You see, it is the wisdom of the wise that has been learned through hard experience. practicing that law of cause and effect again and again and again. And finally, you get the wisdom, you get the clarity. Nothing else will bring me that happiness, that love, that joy, that bliss that I so yearn to know. Nothing else will be lasting. Everything else of us, temporary nature. And so now I seek to do God's will only. Seek to do God's will only. And that is even if it is to your own death. What of it? This life is temporary. For most, it's 60, 70, 80 years, and then it's done. So what if it takes your life? Look at Jesus' example. A young man still, much to live for. God asking him to make his ultimate sacrifice for what and who? For his friends, he says. For there is nothing greater than to give your life for your friends. Why? Because he is paying the price and he is showing the way in a very literal kind of way. What we must go through spiritually in order to attain the kingdom of heaven. We must surrender ourselves completely and totally. And why? In order to gain everything. In order to enter into that eternal kingdom of which we are always a part. There are so many experiences that come to you. Jesus himself said, there are many mansions in my Father's kingdom. There are many levels of experience. That you can feel God, that you can know God in all people at great distances is very true. It's different than psychic power. It's different than astral projection. You feel your oneness with God, and in that oneness you feel yourself united with all humanity, with all minds, with all hearts. And sometimes that's not an easy thing to do. Sometimes you feel the suffering of so many. What gives you the strength to be able to do that? It is God within you. That grace pours upon you to allow you in loving compassion to be with the suffering that others go through. And if it is God's will, perhaps in this way, you will help those individuals through that suffering. It is not Jesus alone who was able to vicariously serve those who would follow after him. But you do this only at God's will. As you see, if you do this before you're prepared to do it, then it draws you back into the pain and the suffering and separation from God. But be that one that no matter what experience comes to you, it draws you further toward God, not separates you from God. If you are in pain, let that pain draw you further into God, reliance on God, need for his grace. If you are in loneliness, then feel that that is loneliness for God. And let your heart bleed and open in that divine yearning for union, even if it causes you great pain. Feel that that pain is God yearning for himself through your own heart. Whatever situation is given to you, you see, whether it is humble or whether it is high in this world, it makes not a difference. Remember Jesus seeing the old woman going up to the altar, and it's after all these men of wealth and prestige have come up and given great gold and all of these different things, and she lays one little penny on the altar. But she does it with such love and such devotion. And Jesus peers through his union with God. He knows her mind. He knows her consciousness. He knows that's everything that she has. And she gives it unto God. And he says, as an instruction to his disciples, look at that woman. What she gives is more than what all of these others have given combined. Just think. She thought she was all alone in this world, unnoticed. And yet God was watching. God was loving her. God was giving her all the grace that there is. Mother, when she sent down her last $3 to Master and sent it to him, and he sent her back a check and said, thank you for, I think it was generous contribution, and sent her a check for $6 back. Just think of receiving it, what Master must have felt as he received those $3. The love, the devotion, the everythingness that Mother had for him. So great that she felt for him, that she felt that he was Christ come again. Imagine, many people imagine what it might be like if Christ were to walk this earth again. And how thrilled they would be. Here, this mother, this guru, this divine mother, felt so greatly towards her own guru. And they both had lives of suffering. They both had difficulties. And yet when they came to me, when I was at Cloud Mountain, and they came, and they were both filled with such joy, and they would start laughing. And the laughter would start vibrationally down in their stomach areas. And it would just come out as waves. And one would start laughing, and then the other one would start laughing. And it was complete joy. Complete joy. And these waves would go out, and they would just become liquid-like and just roll out and go out. And it was just such a joyful time. Just such a joyful time. Just think what's waiting for you in your kingdom of heaven. And you don't have to wait until you die. That's such a complete fallacy. It's a complete misinterpretation of the Master's teachings. It's exactly opposite of what he came to teach. It was the greatest travesty. When those who were in charge began to teach that it was something that would come later, that the kingdom of heaven is here, it's now, it's within you, these were the Master's own words. How dare they change them? How dare they take away the promise of what he came to give? This is a great travesty, and it's due to ignorance. They couldn't conceive it in their own selves, and so they couldn't conceive it for anyone else. It's like the so-called spiritual teacher who told me any guru who comes after Master would block his light. Can you imagine such a thing? It's only because the ego in that one couldn't imagine being a blazing light for Master. Do you think that Master came for any other purpose than to awaken that same innate divinity within each and every one of us? This is a travesty that these things are taught and perpetuated. And it is time, it is past time, that we awaken to the truth that the divine consciousness is within you. It's seeking to be awakened. Do not believe, either through your own mind or anyone else's, that you are anything other than a divinely created being. And that all that God is within you. Let us strive to know this, to seek it out, to become this, and to realize what the great masters have realized. This great householder, Yogi Kabir, I love his teaching so much, his poetry. He would sit at his loom and weave his threads into clothing, but more than that, he wove with divinely inspired threads these beautiful poems. And this one, he says, O my heart, let us go to that country where dwells the beloved, the ravisher of my heart. There love is filling her pitcher from the well, yet she has no rope wherewith to draw water. There the clouds do not cover the sky, yet the rain falls down in gentle showers. O bodiless one, do not sit on your doorstep. Go forth and bathe yourself in that rain. There it is, ever moonlight and never dark. And who speaks of one sun only? That land is illuminated with the rays of a million suns. This was his experience, you see. It is the rain of bliss and joy. Stand out in it. Don't be in the porch watching it from afar, wishing. Go out and feel that bliss raining down upon you. And that light, not just one sun, but a million suns. A million suns, the light of that, and yet it will not burn you. It will not burn you. It will illumine you and bring you into your oneness with Him. Let us close with one of Master's beautiful chants. Who tells me thou art dark? Now in India, the Divine Mother is sometimes pictured as dark. Mother Kali is completely black. And also that this creation, which is a creation of Divine Mother, is also dark and filled with darkness. So he's saying, who tells me thou art dark, O my Mother Divine? Thousands of suns and moons from thy body do shine. This is both within and without. This cosmos is made up of billions of suns. Billions and trillions of suns. But within you is the million suns that Kabir talks about. Who tells me thou art dark, O my Mother Divine? Who tells me thou art dark, O my Mother Divine? Thousands of suns and moons from thy body do shine. Thousands of suns and moons from thy body do shine. Who tells me thou art dark, O my Mother Divine? Who tells me thou art dark, O my Mother Divine? Thousands of suns and moons from thy body do shine. Thousands of suns and moons from thy body do shine. Who tells me thou art dark, O my Mother Divine? Who tells me thou art dark, O my Mother Divine? Thousands of suns and moons from thy body do shine. Thousands of suns and moons from thy body do shine. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet and surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection
surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with thy healing light.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with thee.
my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Amen. Pranams. I bow to the light within you.